From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Chris Mooney about his new book, The Republican War on Science. He says the right has a strong track record of deliberately attempting to undermine scientific work that might threaten the economic interests of private industry or the moral agenda of religious conservatives. He cites global warming, stem cell research, evolution, and condom effectiveness as some of the areas that the Bush administration is at odds with the scientific establishment. Then we'll get a response from former Congressman Robert Walker. In the 2000 presidential campaign, he advised George W. Bush on science and technology policy. He says that many scientists who criticize the president have a liberal agenda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, The Republican War on Science, my guest Chris Mooney charges that the Bush administration downplays or ignores scientific evidence pertaining to issues like global warming, stem cell research, evolution, and condom effectiveness because of business or religious considerations. Mooney is a journalist who writes about the intersection of science and politics. He's a senior correspondent for the American Prospect and Washington correspondent for Seed magazine, which covers science and culture. You describe Republicans in general, and the Bush administration in particular, as waging a war on science. And you argue that this war is coming from two directions. One is from business, and the other is from the religious right. What is the motivation and strategy of each as you see it? Let's start with the business end.
Well, I would actually say that the war on science is quite opportunistic, and so there's no central technique that's being employed. Rather, a variety of techniques are being employed to attack information that people don't like. But actually, one strategy that is quite common is the use of think tanks in order to create, quote, expertise that is in contrast to mainstream scientific expertise as articulated by university-based scientists. So this is something that you see quite strongly, for example, on the issue of global warming, where conservatives have their own experts, and they're often based at think tanks rather than in the academy.
Why is that a problem for you, that there are conservative think tanks?
Well, because they're often distorting the information or attacking the scientific consensus view on climate change, which is that humans are causing the problem now. That would be a good example. And on the evolution example, to switch to the conservative Christian or religious right constituency, we see something very similar where you have the Seattle-based Discovery Institute, which is leading the charge against evolution. Again, these are both very firmly established scientific views, and they are the mainstream consensus positions endorsed by the National Academy of Sciences and other respected bodies. But the right has created its own politicized sources of expertise, and then this is how science gets politicized, because politicians appoint themselves to say, I'm going to pick my own scientists rather than listening to a broader consensus position.
You also say that that a lot of people are using the word good science or sound science,
right,
to actually oppose the scientific community. And an example, you say, is happening within the effort to minimize the importance of global warming.
Sound science is a PR phrase that the right uses to describe something very different than good science. When you look at how sound science is used, what it seems to mean, as far as I can tell, there's no official definition. There's just a lot of politicians and interest groups using it, but it seems to mean science with a high burden of proof, and you don't take action until you have a high burden of proof satisfied. The problem with that, of course, is that's a policy decision, and sometimes if you wait to satisfy a specific, very high scientific criterion, the problem may already have gotten out of control. So on global warming, this is actually using the phrase sound science as part of the talking points that have been put forward for Republican politicians by pollster Frank Luntz for talking about the environment. And actually, in the Luntz memo, a kind of infamous document telling Republicans how to talk about the environment, not only does he advise using the phrase sound science, but when you look at what that means on global warming, it means continue to attack the science and find your own experts to dispute the mainstream view. So that's what sound science apparently means there.
So you're saying that this is a technique to keep saying, oh, the evidence isn't good enough, so you have to keep proving it further and proving it further, thus delaying any regulatory action.
Right. Phrases have been used like manufacturing uncertainty or paralysis by analysis. I think both are good descriptions of what's going on here.
There's actually a group called the Sound Science Caucus in Congress, led by Chris Cannon of Utah. What is their goal?
Well, I don't know how active a group this is. Certainly it was announced. But it's very interesting. If you go to the website of Cannon's website, and the Western Caucus of the House of Representatives also talks about sound science. And they actually talk about what they mean by sound science in public policy. And specifically, I think they're talking about the Endangered Species Act. And they say that environmental laws should require a high burden of proof. And again, this is not a scientific position, because you'll find that within regulatory agencies using science, sometimes you have to use what science you have to take action immediately in a precautionary way, because if you don't act, the problem could get worse. And so that is a policy judgment about how much of a precautionary angle you take. The problem is that the right claims that its notion, they don't like precautionary decisions using science. They claim that that's a scientific position. It's not. It's a policy position to delay action, and they don't define what they're doing properly. That's why they're misusing science.
Now, you basically accuse the Bush administration of having a double standard for science, depending on whether they want an initiative to pass or they want to delay it. An example that you use is the Bush administration's support of the ballistic missile defense versus its position on, say, global warming. How would you compare how the Bush administration has used scientific evidence in both of those cases?
Well, science is always characterized by uncertainty. Scientific conclusions are, by their very nature, tentative, subject to revision. This is, I think, a strength of science. But what happens in the hands of political actors is that uncertainty is frequently used to get what you want. So the Bush administration will selectively cite the remaining uncertainty in global warming, in the global warming account, and use that in order to delay action. Ironically, there's tons of uncertainty about whether missile defense can actually work, and yet they're willing to stampede ahead with that program. So they have shifting standards for the role of that scientific uncertainty should play in justifying a decision.
Now, so how do scientists talk about uncertainty when making the case for global warming, when saying that global warming is a phenomenon that does exist and may affect our future on Earth pretty dramatically? There is uncertainty surrounding that. How do scientists write about that uncertainty?
Well, if you look at the studies, I think that they generally characterize it pretty clearly. You'll get something like, this conclusion is very likely. And then there'll be a footnote saying, we consider very likely to be in the 90 to 99% certainty range. So they actually try their best to attach a range of percents to the strength of the conclusions that they have.
But the scientists would say that, but the evidence is strong enough to proceed with action to prevent further global warming.
Yes. They can't say that it's 100% certain, but they will say that it's quite strong at this point. And if you wait for that evidence, if you wait, you may never get 100%. And if you wait, then the problem could be just getting worse. And that's the problem. And, you know, I mean, there's uncertainty throughout science. Evolution, for example, extraordinarily well established in the scientific community, and yet there are uncertainties there. There are many things that happened millions of years ago that we can't give you a direct, perfect account of how it played out, and yet the evidence supporting the evolutionary explanation is staggering.
So you're arguing that when politicians don't want to move forward with an initiative for political or economic or religious reasons, that they will exploit the uncertainties that scientists have, even if that margin of uncertainty is very narrow.
Right. They selectively cite uncertainty and they ignore the mainstream conclusion, whereas in fact, uncertainty is part of the mainstream conclusion. And so by exaggerating uncertainty or selectively citing it, you're misrepresenting what the scientific community knows and has established.
You say that there are certain catchphrases that business or groups on the religious right have been using to fight the scientific community and to oppose them. Are there certain phrases you want to call our attention to?
Definitely. One of the phrases is sound science. Another one is junk science. So the right attacks a lot of environmental science by denouncing it as junk science. The accusations usually, I find, don't actually add up. And so it's just a catchphrase to denigrate scientific information that people don't like a lot of the time. Sound science is, in the right's mind, the alternative to junk science, which, of course, means that we should be skeptical of what they mean by sound science as well. And then the new one is data quality, which describes the Data Quality Act, which conservatives are very fond of, which sets up a process in government whereby industry and special interests can attack scientific information they don't like. So again, we should be careful about data quality as well.
My guest is journalist Chris Mooney. His new book is called The Republican War on Science. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Chris Mooney, and he's the author of the new book, The Republican War on Science. Now, you write about intelligent design in your book, which you describe as a way to cloak creationism in science. And I think you see intelligent design as a way to bring creationism into schools after the Supreme Court said in 1987 that creationism couldn't be taught in the Supreme schools, in the public schools, because it was actually a religious point of view and therefore violated the First Amendment.
That's right. The irony here, of course, is that creationism has evolved over time in American life in response to legal and political precedents. So first, going back to the Scopes trial, they tried to ban the teaching of evolution. And the Supreme Court nixed that in 1968. There was a little problem with the First Amendment. And so then the creationists claimed that they had creation science and that it should be taught as an alternative to evolution. And the Supreme Court nixed that in 1987, saying, you know what, your creation science is not science, it's religion. Again, First Amendment. Now we have intelligent design, which is the latest version of creationism appropriating science and masquerading as science, even though it remains religion. And the only difference is that intelligent design is, I would say, politically slicker and more savvy and contains less actual content that you can refute or challenge or even make fun of, because the creation scientists, of course, were trying to justify, use geology to show that Noah's flood happened, and they were talking about how Noah could have fit dinosaurs on the ark and all these sorts of things. So intelligent design people aren't committed to any of that, but there's not much scientific content to their view at all.
How would you describe the theory of intelligent design?
Well, I wouldn't describe it as a theory. It's sort of a philosophical conjecture at best. It's the notion that living things are too complex to explain through a mindless or directionless process, and that therefore a designer is required to explain them. This is an old philosophical argument that's been around forever. And I don't believe that this is scientific for the following reason. You cannot study who the designer is, how the designer operates, why the designer operates, and frankly, if the designer is meddling and interfering with the history of life over and over again, you also can't study why the designer couldn't get it right the first time. Another question is, who designed the designer? All of these questions are completely unanswerable by science, which means you cannot, there's no data, and you cannot get two scientists to independently agree on the answer. That's why it remains in the realm of philosophical or metaphysical speculation.
Now, President Bush has said that he thinks intelligent design should be taught with evolution in the public schools, quote, so people can understand what the debate is about, unquote. And he said, quote, I think that part of education is to expose people to different schools of thought. You're asking me whether or not people ought to be exposed to different ideas, and the answer is yes. What's your critique of that response?
Well, you don't just teach any conjecture that someone has come up with in science class. There has to be a vetting process to establish what is actually accepted by the scientific community. Intelligent design doesn't pass the standard. I mean, think about it. We don't teach magic alongside physics. We don't teach the stork theory of birth in sex ed class. The 21st century is projected and expected to see dramatic advances in biology and biotechnology. We are undermining our competitiveness if we systematically misinform students about the fundamental theory of biology, which is evolution.
So you're arguing in your book that science is facing opposition on two fronts now under the Bush administration. One is from business, from certain businesses or certain people within those businesses that don't want to undergo further government regulation, and therefore they're arguing certain scientific premises like global warming.
Or they're attacking the science, yeah.
Or they're attacking the science. And at the same time, science is getting attacked by certain religious groups that disagree with science and prefer a more biblical-based point of view.
Or the religious groups actually might want to appropriate science as a way of, a stealth way of achieving what is really their moral end. A great example of this is in the embryonic stem cell area, where religious conservatives, they think embryonic stem cell research is immoral. they think it's murder because embryos are destroyed in the process. Do they argue that? Yes, but you know what they also argue? They also argue that there's a scientific alternative to embryonic stem cell research. They hold up adult stem cell research and they say, we don't need to proceed with embryonic work because adult stem cells will give us everything that we need. Scientifically, specifically scientific argument, rejected by the National Institutes of Health, the International Society for Stem Cell Research. So again, they come up with this scientific outlier argument and they use it to advance their political goals. And that's why science is being abused.
How well do you think science is fighting back against what you perceive as a war on science?
Scientists have started to get really outraged, and they're doing a good job speaking out. They might do more. The key moment was February 2004, when the Union of Concerned Scientists brought together a very distinguished cast of scientific luminaries and former science policymakers from previous administrations, and this included 20 Nobel laureates, denouncing systematic abuses of information by the Bush administration on a wide range of issues. And that really caught people's attention. I think that the scientific community needs to remain involved and engaged. What I'd like to see is the university community specifically get involved more in these fights. I think university presidents should be standing up for the teaching of evolution. I think there should be a college-level scientific integrity movement. If we can't defend scientific inquiry on colleges, where can we defend it?
Now, President Bush's science advisor, John Marburger, is a former university president. He's the former president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. What is your evaluation of his performance as science advisor? Where do you see him as fitting in this war on science?
The scientific community and the Union of Concerned Scientists and many others have documented clear cases in which science has been distorted and abused in service of political goals by the Bush administration. I have looked into these and substantiated many of them in my own book. Dr. Marburger has pretty much flatly denied the allegations. And unfortunately, in flatly denying them, he often doesn't really tackle the real issue. And so this is really too bad. And I don't know, I can't tell you what's going through Dr. Marburger's head. I can tell you this. Dr. Marburger spoke out very strongly in defense of the teaching of evolution. He has called it, I believe, the bedrock of biology. And he has said that intelligent design is not science. And yet when the president came out for the teaching of intelligent design, there was Marburger defending the president. I don't understand how this is possible. I think Marburger sees it as his job to defend the administration rather than scientific integrity, and I think that's unfortunate.
Now, you're a journalist, and your specialty is covering the intersection of science and politics. You're critical of a lot of science journalists, and you write that reporters need to understand how science abusers exploit the journalistic norm of balance. What do you mean?
Sure. There's very common in journalistic coverage is an approach that I might call he said, she said, we're clueless. It's an approach in which the journalist abdicates their responsibility to, at least to some extent, evaluate the credibility of competing claims. So there may be some science debates where there's an actual debate and in which, you know, you don't know which side is right. There's very credible people on either side, and you probably should balance your account there. But the problem is on something like global warming or evolution, what you find is that there's a strategic attempt to create a controversy for political reasons that does not exist within the scientific community. And when journalists apply the balanced approach in their coverage of these topics, what they are doing is aiding and abetting the strategy of the people who are abusing science. So they need to be aware of this. I think journalists are becoming increasingly aware of it. I'd like to see more. And so I hope that that will happen.
So basically what you say in your book is that things that you would describe as pseudoscience are given equal weight to science in the attempt to be fair to both sides.
Right. I don't always like to use the word pseudoscience because it's been challenged on a philosophical level in terms of whether we can actually determine what is pseudoscience and what isn't. Rather, it's when there is a clearly established mainstream scientific consensus view in the scientific community, that's a very powerful thing. It's been established over a long period of time. Independent investigators have all reached agreement, and it's been thoroughly vetted by the scientific community. In that situation, where there is no controversy occurring in scientific journals, which is, of course, just a venue where scientists debate scientific ideas. And that is the case, especially for evolution. There's really no controversy in scientific journals. Then the press should not be involved in constructing an artificial controversy that does not exist. They should not be misrepresenting the science to their readers. Now, they should write about a political controversy, but they should clearly characterize the state of scientific understanding as they cover the politics.
Chris Mooney is the author of The Republican War on Science. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of portable professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. And from The Wall Street Journal, introducing the new Saturday Weekend Edition, designed to inspire when it's time to unwind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science, and we get a response from former Congressman Robert Walker. He's the former Republican chair of the House Committee on Science. During the 2000 presidential campaign, he served as George W. Bush's advisor on science, space, and technology. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Chris Mooney, author of the new book, The Republican War on Science. The book makes the case that the Bush administration, and the right in general, tried to alter or slant the results of science based on political or religious considerations. Mooney is a journalist who covers the intersection of science and politics. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect and Washington correspondent for Seed Magazine. I want to talk a little bit about the hurricane. You are from New Orleans. You grew up there.
That's right.
Your parents still live there. Your brother, well, your parents had lived there. They're not
right
there at the moment.
We don't know if they're going back or when.
And your brother, too.
Yeah, my brother's a jazz musician, so he's hit the hardest by this. Now he has, you know, he's lost his musical community in a sense.
You wrote a piece last May about the possibility of a major hurricane and how it could destroy the city. Let me quote a little bit about what you wrote. You wrote about how a storm could generate a 20-foot surge that would overwhelm the levees. And you said, quote, "Soon the geographical bowl of the Crescent City would fill up with the waters of the lake, leaving those unable to evacuate with little option but to cluster on rooftops, to rain they would have to share with hungry rats, fire ants, nutria, snakes, and perhaps alligators. The water itself would become a festering stew of sewage, gasoline, refinery chemicals, and debris." Well, this article you wrote in May turned out to be a, you know, a pretty close description of what's actually happened in New Orleans. When you wrote that, did you really believe that you would actually witness this just a few months later?
Not a few months later, but I knew that the big one would come eventually. And I was actually lobbying my family to pay attention to this, and my brother, at my advice, did buy flood insurance for his home only a few months before it happened. So that was great that I had that effect. Unfortunately, people like me, and of course the scientists that I relied upon to report that story, it wasn't hard to find this information. There have been scientists who've been fretting about this for years. Unfortunately, my brother listened, but political leaders didn't listen when they could have a long time ago, and they might have launched a major engineering project to strengthen the hurricane protections of New Orleans. I think it's unacceptable to potentially lose an American city. I think that we should have spared no expense, but unfortunately we did not.
In your book, The Republican War on Science, you talk about the role of conservative think tanks in arguing against scientific consensus on certain issues. What are a couple of those issues, and what is the approach of the think tanks? Why do you think they're important in this?
The think tanks are important because in order for Republican politicians to cherry-pick scientific expertise that supports their political views, they got to be able to point to a couple of experts that agree with them. And once that contrary expertise exists, then it's much easier for science to become politicized. So on the global warming issue, there are a number of think tanks that are supporting the conservative position and that are in some way challenging the science. So, for example, there's the Competitive Enterprise Institute. On evolution, the central think tank is the Discovery Institute. What is generally in common about the strategy is that you have a well-established view that is coming out of university-based science. And this is where I believe the repository of scientific expertise on these issues generally is in this country. And if you don't like that view, you not only have to attack it, but you have to generate your own sources of alternative expertise to muddy the water and attack it. And I think that's one of the reasons that the politicization of science has become so bad.
Are you arguing with the scientists at think tanks' qualifications as scientists?
Well, these people are often PhDs, and I'm not saying that they don't believe what they say. That's not the point. The point is that politicians need to listen to scientific consensus conclusions, not cherry pick a couple of outliers, because we need the best available science to serve as the foundation for policy. So it's not that these people don't necessarily believe what they say. I'm not saying that. It's just that we can't selectively use information when, with something like global warming, the world itself may be at stake.
You're very critical of the Bush administration's relationship to science, and it's as you put it, cherry-picking of science. Could you point to a president that you think had a very productive relationship with science in a way that you think benefited the nation?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm not saying that no other administration has distorted science, so let's make that clear. I'm just saying that the Bush administration is doing it systematically and is dramatically worse than previous administrations, and there's good, strong evidence for that. An administration that did a great job with science. Let's go back to a Republican president who was governing the nation at a time of what you might call scientific crisis. Eisenhower, the Soviets launched Sputnik, and the nation was very concerned about being behind in the space race and in technology. Eisenhower brought the scientific community into the White House. He created the President's Scientific Advisory Council. And this was really the heroic age, I think, of presidential science advising. It carried on into the Kennedy administration when it was known that Kennedy's science advisor, Jerome Wisner spoke for the president. So it was bipartisan at that point in time that science advice was going to play a really strong role in national policy, and it's really unfortunate that we've lost that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Chris Mooney is the author of The Republican War on Science. We called President Bush's science advisor, John Marburger, but we were told he was unable to schedule an interview with us. Coming up, we hear from Robert Walker, former Republican chair of the House Committee on Science. During the 2000 presidential campaign, he advised George W. Bush on science and technology policy. This is Fresh Air. After speaking with Chris Mooney about his book, The Republican War on Science, we called Robert Walker. During the 2000 presidential campaign, he advised George W. Bush on science and technology policy. Walker is a former congressman from Pennsylvania and was the Republican chair of the House Committee on Science. He's now chairman of the lobbying group Wexler Walker Public Policy Associates. Chris Mooney's main point in his book, The Republican War on Science, is that when it comes to science, the Bush administration is swayed by business interests on the one hand, business interests which don't want to accept studies that might lead to more government regulation. And the Bush administration, on the other hand, is also swayed by Christian groups, groups on the religious right that don't want to accept science that contradicts their fundamentalist biblical views or that contradicts their view of morality. That's the basic premise of the book. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I think it's nonsense. Bush administration has gone overboard to assure that as science is promulgated, that it is appropriately reviewed. Some of the problems we've had in the past is that scientists have not had the kind of review of their science that it should be done. And in recent years, there has even been suspicion risen about the various peer review panels that scientists depend upon, about whether or not some of them have developed a political agenda, in large part because of the kinds of people who are picked to go on those peer review panels. And so the Bush administration has attempted to provide better review of science, but it is nonsense to suggest that scientists are in any way being handcuffed by a religious right agenda or by a business agenda.
Well, what Chris Mooney says to that in his book is that the process that you're describing means requiring a higher burden of proof before action can be taken to protect public health and environment. And, you know, just like raising the bar to an extent where after scientists are confident of their reports, raising the bar even higher and forcing scientists to go back again, make more reports, thus just putting off regulation. Requiring a higher burden of proof to prevent action from being taken.
Well, again, I mean, I just don't agree with that at all. The problem is that if you come from a left-wing perspective, then any regulation which is written is a good thing. The fact is that we are an over-regulated society at the present time, and instead of eliminating regulations as we promulgate new ones, we simply go on and pile on regulation that, in fact, undermines the public interest. And so much of what has been done here is an attempt to even reform the overall regulatory agenda so that the regulations that we have in place really do serve the public interest. I think that that's what's ignored by a lot of left-wing writers and politicians who simply want to grow government bigger and bigger.
No, you keep referring to the left, but what a lot of scientists would say is that science isn't liberal or conservative. Science is science. There's good science and bad science.
Well, the fact is, though, that they pretty much showed their stripes in this last election when even a lot of the scientific societies in the personages of their leaders lined up for the Kerry campaign and voiced a very, very liberal agenda in what they were saying. And so the scientists themselves hardly fit that definition of who they are.
Are you saying that most or all scientists are liberal and therefore
no,
we can't trust them?
No, I don't say that at all, except that I will say that a lot of the scientists come out of a lot of the large universities where there is a basically left-wing political bias on the campus, and scientists in their science may not see themselves as promoting a political agenda. But they have in fact bought into a political agenda inside the atmosphere in which they operate.
Aren't you saying, in a way, well, scientists are at universities. Universities are liberal. Scientists are liberal. Therefore, everything they say has to be taken with a grain of salt. I mean, are you trying to dismiss science by saying liberal can't trust it?
No, not at all. Again, I mean, that is an accusation that gets made, and that's not the case at all. But scientists then have a burden of proof to assure that the peer review that is done of their science is, in fact, a peer review of science and not with a political bias to it. During the 1990s, much of the work that was done on global warming, for example, it became highly suspect because it was being done in an atmosphere that anything that you had to say on the formulation of models for global warming was almost accepted out of hand by the government because the review panels did not represent a broad cross-section of the views on that issue. For example, there were a lot of scientists who spoke out on global warming during the 1990s who have no credentials as climatologists whatsoever. They were people, they were social scientists, they were a whole group of scientists who did not have background in the science to which they were speaking.
Whether that is true, you know, if that is true that there were social scientists who spoke out, there were also many climate scientists who spoke out, and those climate scientists seem to pretty much be in agreement that global warming is a major issue, and global warming is a result, at least in part, of human activities.
The climatologists have not come to that conclusion. And if you look at the broad base of climatologists who have spoken out on the issue, they have been very circumspect about what they've said. They do believe that there is a warming trend, but most of them are unwilling at the present time to say that trend is as a result of some induced activity, that it may well be a part of larger trends, and that's one of the things that needs to be investigated. And that's one of the things where the Bush administration has put a good deal of money, is in trying to figure out just exactly what we're dealing with here. Are we dealing with multi-decadal trends that involve climate being climate, or do we have human-related activity which is having a detrimental impact? And a large portion of the climatology community has not yet come to that conclusion.
Do you think it's a large portion or a minority?
No, I think it's a large portion of climatologists who are not prepared to say that we have global warming and it is absolutely as a result of human activity. You know, the Union of Concerned Scientists and some of the liberal ideology says that, but the climatologists are very, very reluctant to be put in that kind of a position.
You know, when you refer to the Union of Concerned Scientists, the statement that they issued criticizing the Bush administration for manipulating science for political ends, that was signed by about 50 Nobel laureates. Do you feel that all the Nobel laureates' position should be dismissed?
Well, I don't dismiss anybody's position. You know, everybody in our society is perfectly capable of taking a political position, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with people doing that. But let's understand, it's not a science position; it's a political position. The Union of Concerned Scientists, in their reports, engage in politics. And so, do they have some Nobel laureates who agree with them politically? Yes, they do. But let's not confuse politics and science on this.
One criticism I've heard of the Bush administration that certainly Chris Mooney makes in his book is that in most scientific studies, there is a degree of uncertainty because some things are not completely provable. But when that degree of uncertainty is small, you can still proceed and say that this is proven enough. This is pretty scientifically proven. You know, you have to proceed in the face of some degree of uncertainty. What Chris Mooney says in his book, and what I've heard other scientists say, is that the Bush administration exploits that small degree of uncertainty and blows it up and makes it seem like, wow, there's so much uncertainty here. How can we possibly accept this as a conclusion?
Well, it kind of depends upon the magnitude of what you are talking about on uncertainty. If you're talking about uncertainty on relatively small experiments where what you want to do is say, okay, we've got enough evidence here to proceed forward and continue to take a look at this, that's one thing. If you're talking about uncertainty about, for example, global warming, where it could be a multi-hundreds of billions of dollars cost to our economy that you make a judgment on, then you'd better make doggone certain that what you're doing is in fact right. And when you see the models that scientists are depending upon called into question, and it could be a matter of disrupting our economy in favor of Europe if you sign on to the Kyoto Treaty, then you better be a lot more certain of what you've got, and those uncertainties become pretty important.
In the 2000 presidential campaign, you advised George W. Bush on science policy. I'm wondering what you think of the movement now to teach intelligent design in the schools. Do you think that intelligent design is good science or is even science?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm really not an expert in intelligent design. I don't think personally that there is anything that is in conflict between evolutionary theory and the Christian belief that there was a creator who was responsible for the beginning of the universe. I think that much of what is in the Bible, and all of what's in the Bible, can certainly be reconciled with evolutionary theory as I understand it. And insofar as intelligent design simply allows a better understanding of that relationship between religion and science, I don't see that there's a huge conflict there.
Do you think that intelligent design should be part of a science curriculum in public schools?
Design, the only statement you have is the president who is asked a question at one point. It is not something where the administration has gone out and pursued a policy on this in any way. The president was asked about it, and he said, sure, both of them ought to be taught, and so on. That's the whole basis of this particular argument. I know of nothing that this administration has done toward trying to push that into the curriculums of the schools. And in all honesty, I think school curriculum ought to be left up to the local people who determine what they want to teach their own kids.
But as a science policy advisor, what is your reaction when you hear the president say that intelligent design should be taught as well as evolution?
Well, what the president really said was that everybody ought to have a chance to hear both sides of the argument is essentially what he's saying. It is not a bad thing intellectually to have challenges in all areas of life. And so the idea that that we completely understand everything about evolution is highly questionable, and I don't think you'd find many scientists who absolutely believe that we know everything there is to know about evolution. What we do know is that we have got a long history of evolutionary trends that have a good deal of science backing to them. Should people understand that about evolution? Absolutely they should, and it should definitely be taught as a part of the curriculum. But But I don't think that evolution ought to be used as a jihad against the people who deeply believe it and have a strong religious faith. And I said before, I don't believe there's a conflict between the two. But the fact is there are some people out there who are trying to create that conflict, and I don't approve of having the conflict.
I think most scientists would say that intelligent design isn't a scientific theory, it's a religious worldview, and that a religious worldview does not belong in a science class and doesn't belong in a public school. Do you think that intelligent design is science or religion?
As I told you before, I'm not an expert on intelligent design in any way, shape, or form. I do believe that those who are out trying to promote an agenda that suggests that evolution is in conflict with the Bible, in fact, are doing a disservice. And whether that comes from the scientific community or from the religious community, I think it's a disservice to put the two at odds, where I don't personally see any reason for them to be at odds.
My guest is Robert Walker. In the 2000 presidential campaign, he was the Bush advisor on science and technology issues. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Walker, former Republican chair of the House Committee on Science. During the 2000 presidential campaign, he advised George W. Bush on science and technology policy. We asked him to respond to Chris Mooney, author of the book The Republican War on Science. Let me quote something that you said in September 2004 that's been widely quoted. I'd like to know what you meant when you said it and set the record straight. You said that the scientific community could face, quote, a pushback at some point in the future, unquote, for its criticism of the Bush administration. What did you mean when you said that?
Well, what I said, I didn't say, I don't think, I think you added a paraphrase on there about the Bush administration. What I said was that scientists, because of their political activity, could in fact face a pushback. And what I meant by that is, if in fact their science and what they have to say on science is judged in the same vein as the way in which they are approaching politics, they are going to lose a lot of the confidence. When they speak as scientists and speak where their expertise is, they, in fact, have a lot of credibility, and over the years have had credibility with me when I was the science chairman and so on. When their science agenda appears to become mixed with their political agenda, then there are people who will raise questions about whether or not they are giving us all the facts and being entirely credible. And that is a concern to me. I mean, I am somebody who believes thoroughly in the investment of science, and I pursued that on Capitol Hill. And when Newt Gingrich was Speaker and I was Chairman of the Science Committee, we began the trend toward moving up the amount of investment this country did in science. And I think that scientists can undermine their own cause by mixing a great deal of political judgment into their science presentations.
Are you ever concerned that by calling scientists liberal and politicized and therefore biased and not worthy of taking all that seriously, that you are urging people to close their ears and eyes to what scientists are telling them?
No, I'm worried the other way. I'm worried that scientists have in fact created a situation where You will get a vast portion of the population that will say these guys are simply promoting another political agenda, so that when they have something really serious to tell us, the people will be somewhat skeptical of what they say. That's my concern, and that's exactly what I was telling them when I spoke at that point before the AAAS. The AAAS, which, by the way, at the time I spoke, had both its president and its chairman on the Kerry campaign.
And I should mention that the AAAS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Right.
Robert Walker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, sure.
Robert Walker was the science and technology advisor to George W. Bush during the 2000 presidential campaign. He's now chairman of the lobbying group Wexler Walker Public Policy Associates. Earlier, we heard from Chris Mooney, author of the book The Republican War on Science. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close today's show with a recording by guitarist Clarence Gatemouth Brown. He died Saturday in Texas, where he had gone to escape the hurricane. He lived near New Orleans. He was 81 and had lung cancer and heart disease.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we observe the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance for the victims of Katrina. Our guests will include historian Douglas Brinkley, writer Alice Siebold, a preacher who rescued people from his community, a cop who rescued inmates in a flooded prison, and a priest who was evacuated to the Superdome. Join us for the next Fresh Air.